Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to another Just Tennis Talk Show Radio. I'm your host, Coach Wes Fuller, along with my super talented co-host, Susan Nardi. Hey, Susan, how you doing today? Or this evening?
Oh, I'm doing awesome in U.S. How are things in Atlanta? I hear it's not hot Atlanta anymore. I hear it's icicle Atlanta.
Oh, yes, Lord. I mean, I figured it out. I went out the other day. It was cold. And one of the kids was running around, and he had on his sweatpants, and he was sweating. And I knew I was running him, but I was like, why are you so warm? And he told me the secret. He has his pajamas, his flannel pajamas underneath his sweatpants, and he said the flannel pajamas keep him warm. Oh, it was so funny. It was cold. I mean, it was the balls. You throw the balls up in the air, they wouldn't bounce. It was cold.
They were more like snowballs, huh?
Yes. But then my mother, I mean, I hate to hear about the people in the D.C. area. I mean, they're expecting about 20 to almost between 20 and 30 inches of snow. You know, I called my mother the other day and asked if she wanted to come down here before Friday because they are expecting a big blizzard.
Yeah, that's what I hear because I'm from that area of the world and originally, and you know, I've been in touch with all my friends and, you know, they're all just bearing down. I mean, you know, at least it's going to head over the weekend, but there's still going to be, probably affect Monday's traffic and they'll probably all have a lot of things closed down. So, yeah, I mean, I hope people are safe. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if the government shuts down on Monday, so.
Listen, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, my wife showed me a picture of a friend's. It's snowing there now, and I told her that's not even a storm yet because the original storm is coming out of Colorado. But what do you think about the Australian Open so far?
It's Australian Open is always a fun tournament. Some interesting results in play. I hate to say I'm not surprised Nadal got knocked out in the first round. I would have expected he would have gotten knocked out early. He's definitely not in the same form as he once was, that's for sure. Venus losing like she did. There's some interesting developments. I still think it's Djokovic's tournament. I think somebody has to knock him off that pedestal. We'll see what Serena really does. I still think it's her tournament. We'll see if Azarenka or Sharapova. I know Sharapova's in her half of the draw. We'll see if anybody can really challenge her. But they got to knock. You got to knock the big dogs off.
I was shocked. I was shocked, especially from Badastra. I was shocked at Nadal. I mean, I was shocked at Nadal. Venus, I'm actually kind of bored of. I mean, my motto is I don't think that she goes out there to really think that she can win the tournament. So give it up to a younger person. I mean, I do understand. I mean, I just don't think that she gives it her all to go out there and win. And sometimes you outdo your legacy. You know, I think that it'd be good for her to retire. Just give it up to some young wild card. I don't know how they would work it, but give it up to some young, because it's just heartbreaking to see her play now after the years of great play. It just didn't seem like she wanted to miss.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't see the match personally. She had such a big year last year and came back from, she's got that immune problem, fatigue problem. So, and she came back and she had a strong year last year where she got herself back in the top 10. So, I don't know. It'll be interesting. I can't imagine her wanting to play much longer. I mean, I would be surprised if she plays past 2017. But, you never know. I mean, she might not play singles and play doubles. I mean, who knows what she'll do. But, she's got other things that she's interested in her design business. So we'll see what she does. But I'm excited about tonight. I've been roaring and just all excited about tonight's show. I mean, I've been just full of energy all day today. So,
oh Lord, well, we've got a good one tonight. We've got your buddies, a friend of mine too, and someone I call coach. But we've got a coach that has 35 years of high school and of team coaching and of instructing and of putting out quality work. A coach that is an advocate for tennis, that is a bestseller, that has multiple books, tennis and children's books, and then other books that I find very interesting. I find that very interesting. You know, he's a great, great, great coach. He's a great mentor to me as a coach, and you know, I know what he is to you. So I'm going to let you go ahead and introduce our special guest. I've got my popcorn sitting right here. I'm just going to just enjoy the show. Go ahead, Forster.
Well, I don't know how many adjectives, wonderful adjectives, I can come up to create about my good friend Dave Smith, who I have known for 20-some-odd years, which kind of seems like yesterday. But there's nothing that he hasn't done. He's taught high school. He taught high school. He coached high school in three different states. He's run very successful programs and large programs. He has a no-cut policy, and we're going to dive in a lot to that about his philosophy, why he does that, what he's been able to do from that. But he's not only won state championships, he's produced state championship players that weren't state championship players and that weren't on his varsity team, is, you know, their freshman or sophomore year and come up. He's produced nationally ranked players. He's produced pro players. He's run clubs. He's in very successful clubs. He's, you know, an author, a publisher. And he even plays in a band. And you know what? You know, he plays in a band and he wears plaid shorts. He's number one on my list. So my good friend Dave Smith, are you out there?
Well, after all that, I think I'm just going to hang up and listen to the show. Thank you, Susan. Great to be here. Great to be with you guys.
Well, it is great to have you. It's great to have you here. So I'm excited because I've been thinking about this all day. I don't know about Wes. He's been out there on the court probably dressed up like a Eskimo, freezing. You know, it's about 70 degrees here in East Texas as a high. So, you know, kudos for East Texas. But I'm gonna let Wes start it off with the first question and stuff, and then I'll kick it in from there. So, Wes, what question do you have for Coach?
First, I'd like for the audience and I'd like for the listeners to get a chance to hear a little bit about Coach Dave, you know, have him tell us a little bit about himself. You know, you and I know him, and some people know him, but some people don't know him. I mean, they know him from, you know, from comments and from different things. But I'd like, you know, for him to share a little bit of insight of why he got into high school, why he got into coaching and coaching tennis and the passion that he has for high school tennis. I mean, I think it's very remarkable for you know, when I look at high school tennis, honestly, let me be honest with you, when I'm here in Georgia where tennis is hot, when I look at high school tennis, I don't see the passion. I don't see what I feel from Coach just from reading. I feel passion from him. I don't see that personally from anyone up here. And I'd just like for Coach maybe to give us a quick, you know, bio about himself and talk to everyone about himself, and then go from there.
Well, let me kind of paraphrase the beginning of this. My background started, of course, with my high school career of playing tennis, but before that, my father was California Coach of the Year, National Runner-Up Coach of the Year prior to his death in 1984. And not only was my dad a phenomenal tennis coach, he was also a phenomenal football coach. And so I got, obviously, a firsthand tutelage in watching my father. I actually played against my father's team, and I actually coached against my father's team. And I actually then coached with him when we won the CIF title. We won the very first state champion or CIF championship ever for the entire school district of any sport. Our boys tennis team was the first CIF championship. And so that was a pretty proud thing for us to be part of. But after that, I went into teaching, followed in my father's footsteps, and of course coached tennis, and as well as when I moved to Arizona later. But I coached badminton and golf. So one of the, in addition to tennis. So one of the great things that I learned through coaching was how to generate interest and continue that, well, basically what I would consider growing and sustaining a program that is of high caliber. We did that in California. I did that in Arizona. In California, we won 764 team matches against 9 losses in a 22-year period, and that would have been, that included varsity of Frost-Off. At one time, we won 399 consecutive varsity, junior varsity, and freshman Frost-Off matches, team matches at one point, until we lost our 400th match to Modern Day. So that was our first loss in an 11-year period among all three programs when you're playing a 20-match season, 20 schedule of 20 different matches on three levels. We always had a varsity, always had a JV, and always had a Frost-Off team. That parlayed into when I moved to Arizona later. I did the same thing. We won 312 matches and lost, I believe, 11 matches in my 6 years in Arizona for boys and girls combined. Unlike California and Arizona, we coached boys and girls at the same time. And ironically, I was the only boys and girls coach that did both the boys and girls simultaneously. All the other teams had boys coaches and girls coaches, so I ran my boys and girls together, where most teams kind of broke it up and had their boys practice separately. My goal was to win the state championship in both boys and girls in the same year. Unfortunately, I did it with the boys. I didn't do it with the girls until the year I left. The team I left behind actually did win both the boys and girls state championship in Arizona the very next year after I left. So I felt like I did a good job in leaving it in a good team in good hands. Then I moved to Utah, which was certainly a similar type of environment, not nearly as big as California and about the same size in terms of the number of high schools as Arizona. So that was my high school background. And then, of course, later I became the head pro of a large tennis resort. And then from there, 3 years later, I opened up my own academy. Then I opened up an $8 million fitness facility with tennis. And a few years later, sold my academy and sort of retired into writing, as you mentioned, Wes, publishing not only my tennis books, my Disney books as well, because my background goes back to before I left college. I worked for Disney, so there's some interesting history there. So that's hopefully sums up where I come from, a diverse background of coaching, teaching at the club level, teaching at the both the academy, fitness facility, and a very large tennis resort. Prior to my move to Utah, I was also the director of junior player development at the Wigwam Resort in Arizona while I was coaching high school tennis in Arizona. So lots of diversity in my background, which taught me tremendously a lot about training, organizing, coordinating, and various things.
Cool. All right. A question. I do have a question for you, Coach, after hearing that. It's something, I guess, it came from your conversation. I mean, just so I guess in your bio. Why do we have in the U.S., why do we have such a big problem drawing kids' interest into high school tennis? I see here in Georgia that we have some players. You have players that come out, they don't but you don't have an overwhelming number of players. It's, I mean, I would think that because Georgia is such a popular sport for them, popular state for tennis, it would have a lot of high school, and then even other places. I see you have it sporadically. You have it maybe in this county or this place, but it's not an overall countrywide calling for it. Actually, to me, it's actually almost low. I mean, why do you think that is?
I can answer this because we've talked about it in many situations and I've experienced it, and that is you can't quite put your finger on one entity or one identification point to say this is why. But here's my experience. Number one, we have a lot more diverse activities that kids are interested in today that we didn't have in the 70s and 80s when, of course, tennis was, you know, in a very high peak of interest. We didn't have the various X Games or the extreme sports and things. We didn't have Xbox. We didn't have the Wii. We didn't have all the video game competition, which is obviously detrimental, in my opinion, to all, you know, activity. I think it pulls kids away from doing things outside the house, whether it be tennis, whether it be baseball, I don't care what sport. Thirdly, we have, I think, a lack of leadership at the highest administrative level of the USTA in terms of not really doing what the most that they could do in terms of generating greater interest both on a national level and on a grassroots level. So those are some of the things that I've seen contributing to the downfall. Plus, quite frankly, you have a lot of other countries growing the sport of tennis, just like we see today that where we used to dominate basketball, we see other countries being very competitive in basketball, which never happened prior to, say, you know, the early 90s. So those are, you've got a lot more, definitely a global sport that is being heavily pushed by other countries and seen as a vehicle for a lot of kids in other countries to get maybe a college scholarship or to play professionally or travel and play tennis. So those are the four things that I see very clearly making tennis seem to be far more diminished in the U.S. compared to the global community.
Okay. Susan?
I was curious, Coach, because I know that, you know, I have more insight than most people because I could actually remember going by when you were coaching in California. But you always had large numbers out on the court. And it's one thing to manage it, and we'll get to that question here in a bit. But how were you able to attract so many kids to come? Because I know some coaches that I talk to say, you know, they're just struggling to get enough people to try out. And then, you know, when they get the players, they're like, well, you know, they don't want to say it out loud to anybody, but they're like saying, I'm getting the math athletes. I'm not getting kids that, you know, I'm worried that they can not walk and chew gum. But yet you attract so many different kids to your program.
Well,
and then we'll talk about the development thing. But what are, can you explain to people what you do to get the numbers? To actually have a team and have a thriving team?
Well, let me take a step back from that whole concept. And number one, at the high school level especially, and especially ninth grader boys and girls, but more boys than girls, you do not have a grasp of how good or athletic a kid will be at the ninth grade level. These kids mature at different ages and usually later. And so a kid that might appear to be not a great athlete may become one of your best tennis players because of that fact that I just pointed out. A case in point, and I mentioned this in my book, both my books, I talked about one of my Vietnamese boys that came out as a freshman boy. I had 48 kids on my team. He was number 48. He could not drop and hit the ball with his racket. He was appeared to have very minimal hand-eye coordination. Certainly a player that any coach would probably go, you know what, you're just not going to help us out. You know, I'm going to have to cut you. We never cut players, and so this is a kid that came out to our program. Make a long story short, by his sophomore year, he was the number one doubles player in Southern California. I'm not talking about the Midwest. I'm not talking about some little tiny school somewhere. I'm talking about a kid that won 178 matches at the varsity level in Southern California, reached the semifinals of CIF, reached the quarterfinals of Ojai, as a freshman was the worst player on my team, hands down. So number one, I never rule out any kid of any age, even sophomore, juniors, and even seniors that come out, even though a coach might say, well, how's a senior going to help you down the road? I'll explain that in a minute when we talk a little bit more about the latter. But how we attracted players to our program. Number one, my father before me would go out to the baseball team and ask the kids that got cut from the baseball team, hey, do you want to think about playing tennis? And, of course, the action of hitting a baseball and swinging and throwing has a lot of similarities to tennis. So he saw right away that kids that were cut from the baseball team could fill and become part of his tennis program. But we would go a step further. We looked at tennis. I always encourage tennis players to come out for a sport that is demanding. Come out for the toughest sport on campus. We didn't baby our tennis program. We didn't tell kids, oh, come on out. It'll be just hit and giggle and lots of fun. We told our players, this will be challenging. This will be tough. This will be a sport that will be a demanding sport. Because let's face it, how many kids are going to want to go out to a sport that's easy to learn, simple? You put it on the same level of horseshoes and backyard badminton. I say that tongue-in-cheek because I played badminton at a very high level. But I kind of use that terminology because that's what some people advertise tennis in hopes of getting kids to come out because they don't want to scare them off. They don't want to over-challenge them. Well, we found that kids love a challenge. And the other motivating thing was at our school, my father started this, I continued it, and that is we would put up a year in review, plexiglass 2.5 or 3 feet by 4 feet board up on kind of a Hall of Fame kind of thing. And it would show pictures of all of our players, our team, newspaper clippings, medals, score sheets, player of the year, the most valuable players, the points that they earned throughout the year that we would keep track. And so kids walked by that every single day and would see these pictures of kids that were perpetuated from, we started a 1969 and I left in 1991. So every single year we had a plexiglass Hall of Fame, if you will, of players. And so a lot of kids see that and they go, wow, I'd love to be part of something that prolific and prestigious. Another important factor was our team ladder had all of our previous state champions, regional champions, MVPs and things like that. So again, kids would see the names of people, and it's like one of those trophy cases in a school gym. You know what I'm talking about, where you see old pictures of basketball players and trophies and medals and whatnot. Well, kids love to see that because they look at that and they see someone from 1959 or 1972 or 1987 or whatever, and they go, wow, these guys are like still famous. I mean, they're still known, and a lot of kids, not all, And obviously we're not talking about the entire student body, but a lot of kids look at that and they see that as a chance for themselves to become like those players who are remembered and revered, if you will, by the people who come into that school gym. And so that Hall of Fame served that purpose among, other rounds of things. Like when I would talk, high school, I always showed my classes a top 10 shots of the day kind of thing, what we would call the ESPN Ocho, the top 10 shots of the day, whatever.
Yeah.
Um, and I had an old VHS that I accumulated the top. They used to do the top five, I think, 5 points at the Wimbledon and the top five at the U.S. Open, the top five at the French Open. So I had put, you know, probably 20 or 30 of these shots, which were great. So, I mean, they showed the athleticism, the amazing hands, the quickness, the athletic ability of these tennis pros. And it was showing kids.
Well, you just hit on something that Wes talks about all the time. Isn't that right, Wes? That's your big thing.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, when kids see the problem with tennis is if a kid has not seen the sport at that level, which how many kids watch tennis on television that don't play tennis? Not very many.
Yeah.
So they don't. They only know tennis as, oh, it's that sissy sport that they play out there after school. They don't know what can be done with a racket and a ball, the tweeners, behind the back, the great shots on the run, the, you know, drop shots and overheads and what have you. So I was real big on showing kids that were not exposed to that what tennis was all about. And that's how a lot of my kids came out for tennis.
That's interesting that you put the part about the Hall of Fame as using that similar as a selling tool. I mean, I found that to be interesting. One thing I'd like to know, Coach, something that I don't know, how important is grades? How do you use grades? As a high school coach, do you use grades to leverage, or are grades important? I see that in a lot of these high schools that the coaches don't really care. I mean, not say they don't really care. They're just not knowledgeable about coaching. But how important are grades to you? And in your program, how important was grades, the students maintaining grades and doing what they needed to do in the classroom?
Right. That's a great question, Wes. Number one, I'll approach it from two different perspectives. Number one, good grades means you have a child who sees a value in education. Whether that value is seen because their parents force them and say you better get good grades or else, or you have a kid that goes, these grades are going to open doors for me. So a kid that is got good grades is already ahead of the curve when they come out for tennis, because they've already learned a little bit about setting goals, about time management, about priorities and things like that. The other thing is just the intelligence factor. Tennis is a thinking sport. It is. There's a lot more than just bashing balls over the net. I don't find it surprising that 95% of my teams all had either the valedictorian or someone of that caliber of a student on the tennis team. Very proudly, all my teams were usually had the highest GPA of any sport on campus. So that is a great question, and certainly a point that, yes, I did have a couple students that did not get great grades and still were great tennis players. So it's not exclusive, but the big picture
my question is, let's look at it reversed, not to get off the subject a little bit, but can tennis be a means to making a kid be structured? Say I've got a high school kid that's not structured, that's not really a good student. Would tennis be a tool or a resource to structure that kid's life to make him understand the value of concentration, understand the value of multitasking, understand the value of foreseeing? I mean, there's so many. I mean, if we start looking at the values that tennis could give us, we would go on and on and on for a different lesson. Could tennis be a tool for a kid that's, and I'm not saying they're delinquent, they don't have any mental problems, they're just maybe at home they're not pushed, or for whatever reason they just have not seen academics as important. Could tennis be a resource to structure them?
Absolutely, and I've seen it 100 times. I've seen where kids developed the desire, whether it be because they had to have good grades, I mean, passing grades, obviously, to play on the team, or that they learn through the sport itself how to better manage and prioritize themselves so that they could be successful, and that translated, obviously, into how to prepare for tests, how to study ahead of time rather than wait till the last minute. And those kind of things absolutely can be gained and actually be mentored to kids who otherwise might have not the interest or the acceleration of saying, I want to become a good student. And, of course, we've talked a lot about colleges, and one of the big things that I've found, especially with having a daughter who's a top-ranked golfer, is that when she was being approached by golf coaches around the country, one of the big things was how many of them were looking at their grades, because a college coach who's looking to recruit a tennis player can save a lot of their budget when the school can give them an academic scholarship, and then the tennis scholarship can be a small part to finish out the scholarship, whatever they didn't get academically. So kids that are certainly getting good grades are a talented tennis player needs to keep those grades up and use that as a vehicle to further their education in college and to be able to continue playing tennis, because those that don't have good grades and they're a fairly equal tennis player will not be looked at with near as much interest as the player with good grades. Not to mention the fact that the kid with good grades probably has pretty good work ethic.
So good, yeah.
Okay,
Go ahead, Wes. No, I was going to say just one thing. That's something I tell my kids all the time. Is the work ethic that, you know, learning to play tennis and playing tennis. Start thinking about this as you're now training yourself to be a doctor or lawyer. You know, sometimes you think you're tired. I use the scenario all the time where you've been working, ER working, surgery. I mean, you surge operating for 12 hours. Somebody comes in with a gunshot wound. You still got to be able to perform. You still got to be able to do these things. And I like to use those examples to my kids. And I find a lot of resorts. I mean, one of my kids was a freshman when she came in. She wasn't thinking about the medical field. Now she's graduating now. She's number one in her class. And she's gotten accepted into University of Chicago, all these different high schools. And she tells me all the time, all she can hear is just me always saying, don't you think you're tired now? Wait to become a doctor. Wait to become a doctor. And I think that it's very important. Very important.
Well,
very important.
All I can say is only Wes, you would come up with the doctor thing with the GSW. That's all I can say.
Ironically,
GSW to the chest. Holy cow, Wes, that's pretty intense.
But think about it. But see, that's one of the reasons why, at certain levels, I've stressed to my kids that winning is everything. And when I say that, I don't mean necessarily winning is everything. Is that if they become a surgeon or you become a lawyer, you have to have that winning effort. I'm not saying you've always as a surgeon, somebody's going to kill, but every time. You've got to want to be the best because someone's life could be on the hand. And
I agree with you.
I really pushed that.
I just thought it was funny
that
you came up with a GSW.
Yes. And that's what I tell them. And they can relate. I mean, with today's times, I mean, we can't hide that. They see this stuff on television and they can relate. And I've seen some that it worked hand in foot. The tennis helped them become more mature, but it's a great sport for life.
How many of our tennis players go into either the medical profession or into some other profession because of what they gain from tennis? And I've had hundreds and hundreds of players do that, and I think you all have. We see that all the time, definitely. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. I mean, for sure. Well, I wanted to go back to a statement that you made earlier and let you go on it, and I'm going to do it in two parts. When you talked about that this kid, uncoordinated, he's the 48th player on your team out of 48, okay? And you are at a junior high or a high school, and you've only got four courts.
Yep.
And you haven't cut anybody, and you're managing 48 kids. on four courts.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all different levels. They're
yep.
all different levels. So I want you to first talk about that, and then I want you to talk about, you know, it's most people may not understand this, but it's an El Nino year.
Yep.
And you're dealing with the monsoon rain season
mm-hmm.
where you're going to lose days practicing, and how you, coach, how you handle it, because you know, I know you don't cancel practice.
Nope.
You know, it could be 32 degrees in California, which would be a rare thing where you and I live. But, you know, there has been snow in Cal's Verde, but, you know, that you've had some different approach than what most people say, oh, I'm going to cancel, I'm going to take a day off. So if you could first
yep.
talk about how you manage it during the skill levels and all the different skill levels on low number of courts, 48,
yep.
let's say 48 on four, and then how you do it, what you do on a rainy day, where do you go, what do you do, because I know you don't cancel it. So, yeah.
Yep. Well, let me start with question B first, because I love the idea of rainy day. Here's what most coaches do, and they say, hey, rainy day, go on home. Head on home. We'll pick it up tomorrow, the next day when it stops raining. I look at a rainy day, and my students look at a rainy day, and they say to themselves, we're going to get better while the other kids aren't. Psychologically, and of course they are getting better during a rainy day because of what we do, there's a huge psychological advantage that I love having rainy days. Now, when we had rainy days, we, depending on where I taught, we either had the school gym, but, you know, it's so funny. Tennis coaches think they're, they don't have to practice on rainy days yet. All the baseball teams, they go in the gym on a rainy day. The football team go in the weight room. The track team goes, they find somewhere in the gym. But tennis coaches, a lot of them just say, go on home, we can't practice. They use it as an excuse. And again, it is an excuse. Well, we would go in the gym, and we would either share the gym with the baseball team, because, as you know, Sue, that in California, baseball and tennis, boys tennis, were at the same time of the year. So, but in Arizona, we not only had the boys and girls teams together, we also had the baseball team at the same time of the year, and we had, what was the other sport? There was another sport. Yeah, I believe it was girls softball. So anyway, there was three sports. So we very seldom were able to get the gym, and certainly never got it to ourselves. We had covered hallways. We would use the entire length of the hallway to do a number of drills, which I'll talk about, in because your first question is what I'm going to refer to as, okay, how do you run 45 kids or 40 kids or however many on a narrow hallway that's, you know, 12 feet wide and, you know, 100 feet long. Another thing we would do on a rainy day would be, if we couldn't get to the gym and we had two or three rainy days in a row and we had worked in the hallways, well, we'll go in the classroom and we will study tennis. I had lots of videos on tennis. We had obviously books and magazines, and I all my kids kept notebooks, so they would cut pictures out of the tennis magazines I brought from home. And they'd glue them in their notebooks, and they'd group the pictures by, say, forehand volley, backhand volley, the serve, the ground stroke. And then I would have them write a very brief paragraph under each picture that says, identify where the contact point is. What is the grip? What is the footwork? What's happening in this picture? I wanted the kids to literally look at a picture, not to go, wow, look at that picture. I wanted them to look at the picture and go, this is what's happening. So we use rainy days for many different, you know, chalk talk. I do things on the chalkboard or the dry erase board later. And we would talk about $10,000 shot sequence in singles, double strategies, all the things that I've talked about, like super secret, double secrets, and things like that that I've created over the years. And things like that so that when we would go out on the court, this stuff had meaning. So, you know, those are some of the things we would do on a rainy day. Never, ever, ever, ever did I tell my kids we weren't having practice. I cannot recall a single day in my 28 seasons of coaching tennis that we ever canceled practice.
So did you kind of have
a question.
So did you kind of have like, okay, I have a rainy day. I'm on a rainy day schedule. So I imagine you just didn't fly by the seat of your pants. I imagine you kind of had some sort of ideas. Okay, well, these are the different topics, and these are the different things, activities we can do, physical activities. These are the different things I can do here. So you kind of had like a,
yep,
like a plan, a sketched out outline of, these are maybe 6-7 day rainy day plans that I have for this year.
Well,
like
I would never write it out in a structured format because I never knew when the rainy days would necessarily come. I wouldn't know how many in a row would come, and I didn't know what time during the season they would come. So I wouldn't pre-plan a rainy day schedule because I wouldn't know where I was in, say, if it was the week before region or state or CIF or whatever. I would probably do things a little differently, especially that late in the season. We would probably focus strictly on the varsity players getting ready for state and not be as involved with the whole team. So you can see that there would be exceptions to any pre-program. But my kids all knew because I handed out a 5-page, almost like a class summary, that was as much for the parents as it was for the kids. So they knew if it rains, this is where you meet. When practice starts and what do you wear and what happens on match day, what happens at the end of the match, what happens, what can you do on weekends? I also have a 4 or 5 page handout on all the strokes, especially for the beginners. I wanted them to study the game and learn it as much as they could at home, like homework, if you would. So we had sequences of pictures that we had, if you look in my books, you kind of know what I'm talking about. And these kids, I would tell them, get in front of a mirror. You don't even need a racket. Just mimic shadow swing with your hand what you can do. It's amazing how much learning can take place in a 2.5 or 3 month season. I cannot tell you how fast my kids got better. Going back to your first question of dealing with a large number of kids on a very minimal facility. In Arizona, we had the boys and girls team combined. We averaged about 30 kids on each, both boys and girls. So we had 60 players. I don't know too many teams that have 60 players on their team. We did have 8 courts, so that we had a few more courts and a lot of facilities. But with 60 kids, I don't care, 20 courts, you better be smart about your, what you're doing with your facility. But here's what you do. You've got one court, your varsity players. One thing we would teach all of our players the first week of practice is the players would learn how to feed. Why a coach has to be the feeder, I'll never figure that one out. Now, that doesn't mean I never fed. I did a ton of feeding. But I certainly would not relegate myself to one court and have, the other kids doing diddly squat. So all my players knew how to feed balls from either, in the early days when we didn't have a lot of money, we used 5-gallon buckets. And each court had 2 5-gallon buckets, and I bought used balls from one of the clubs and this other place I bought. They sold used balls for a nickel apiece, and we'd fill those 5-gallon buckets, and they'd basically put one bucket on top of another full bucket, and they'd feed out of that one until it was empty, and then they'd turn that bucket upside down and put the other bucket on top and feed from that. So each kid was responsible learning how to feed and doing either a 6-player or 8-player drill, depending on what we were doing and who was on the court at the time. So number one, we would do a lot of drop feeds, that especially for the beginners, to establish the advanced foundation. So we would have one kid put 20 balls or 15 balls on his strings, and he would drop 15 balls for a specific shot. And you could line up 5, 6, 7 kids with 5 or 6, 7 droppers. So that's anywhere between 10 and 14 kids on one court, on one side. And we would have them start with cross-court sharp angle drop feed hitting topspin angle, because the best way to learn topspin is not going baseline to baseline, but learning how to make the ball dip by going sharp angle. And so we would have kids, you know, lined up, and they would work on two-handed backhands or two-handed forehands or one-handed, whatever the shot was we were working on. Now, let me take another step back and say, okay, I've actually taught 75 players on one court. I've done clinics with 70-plus players. My average drop-in clinic years after my coaching days when I ran my club, we would average anywhere between 15 to 25 players that would come out to my clinic. So I had to learn how to train players so they got their money's worth, not only learn, but that they really got a lot of hitting. Well, one way is what we call toss and block drills. You can teach almost every shot, with the exception of overheads and serves, with the toss and block drills. And that is basically, we always start with a volley first. Those of you who have read my books, you know that the first thing that we teach all beginners is the volley, because we want to teach the continental grip first. We want that to be the first grip and the most important grip, because it's the serve grip, it's the overhead grip, it's the volley grip, it's a two-handed backhand grip on the dominant hand. It's in every shot except for the forehand. So it's a pretty important shot, and yet so many pros or so many coaches teach the forehand ground stroke first, which is usually either an eastern forehand or a semi-western forehand grip. And then suddenly want kids to go to the continental grip for all the other strokes. Well, that's kind of putting the cart before the horse. So we would teach, we would have kids pair up, and they would toss to, say, the backhand. We always started with the backhand volley. We always started with a tougher shot first. So we'd start with toss 25 to their backhand. And the kid tossing the ball would hold their tossing hand up as a target so that the kid volleying was visually in the peripheral aiming for the hand. Now, that is taking the toss and block drill to a higher level. But the idea is that once they start learning the form, then they can start working on aim. And the tosser would toss the ball to their backhand volley from about maybe 7-8 feet away. And the kid would block the ball with the backhand stroke with the form we want, or continental grip, all the factors that make up the continental or the backhand volley. And they'd volley it back to the catcher and the kid that was tossing. And they'd repeat that 25 times and then switch. So you could even run 50 kids with 25 rackets and 25 balls that way. I mean, if you really have very minimal equipment, 25 rackets, 25 balls, you could teach almost every shot. You could teach the forehand volley, the backhand volley, the forehand half volley, the backhand half volley. And then we teach a segmented swing pattern where we tell the kid, okay, a 5 is the full backswing, a 3 is a little shorter, a 2 is shorter, and 1 is even shorter. And we would teach kids, okay, we'd tell them, we want you to do a 2 backswing and a 3 finish. If you know anything about the old USTA or USPTA, what was it called?
System 5.
System 5, thank you, yeah. I call it the segmented swing pattern because we break the swing up the same way. But we tell kids, so you can have a kid toss a ball from a little further, obviously maybe 10 or 12 feet, and make it bounce in front of the kid hitting, say, a two-handed backhand. And then he takes a 2 backswing and a 3 finish, so a very short backswing, a very short finish. And then they learn how to use finesse within the dynamics of hitting a ground stroke pattern. And obviously then that can be taken to the next level of the dead ball drop feed, where they're now taking a full swing, hitting that same stroke. And then that can progress to a 3-ball across drill, a backing out drill, any number of, there's hundreds of drills that you can do from a feed. And we almost never feed from the middle of the court. We would feed from the side of the court, from the angle of the court, occasionally from the middle, but almost never. It was always feed from different angles. So kids learn how to redirect the ball as well as hit different angles from different feet. So diversity is the key to teaching kids and adults how to do more with the ball. The worst thing you can do is stand in the middle of the court and feed a ball to the baseline and tell a kid, okay, hit a topspin cross court. So they're feeling like they've got to hit that ball, you know, all the way from one corner to the other. And they never learn how to hit with angle. They never learn to use topspin to get the ball to dip faster. And if you've seen some of my videos on tennis1.com, which is the site I'm senior editor for, I've got one of the most highly acclaimed set of videos called Training an 8-Year-Old. When I actually trained my daughter, I wanted to actually train her in real time. I didn't want to wait till she was already good. So when she was 8 years old, I started training her and videotaping her to show people how we did it. And by the time she was 9, she was hitting with college players. She had a kick serve. She used a full-size racket at 9. And she had every shot down. And so, you know, those are some of the things that we would do with a large group. And there's many, many more. I mean, I'm obviously I could talk your ear off, which I probably already have. But the idea is that there are many, many ways in which you can effectively train a large group of players.
Good. Very good. I'm sitting here. I've got my notepad. I'm on my fourth piece of paper.
Right, you
have your fourth
piece of paper?
I'm on my fourth notepad. Well, Coach, this has been, I hate to say it, but we've got only a few more minutes left to go in our hour show.
Yep.
This has been great. I mean, this is great. And we're going to ask you to come back. You know we have, because I didn't even have a chance to get into something that I think is something else that's for tennis too, for team, is your lineups. You know, how they talk about stacking lineups and different things. And I like maybe if you could come back maybe in a couple of weeks, or maybe come back and touch on that topic. Because I always find that to be from a team aspect. I'm from a team sport where, you know, you moved up, just because you were the best player, you might have did something wrong. You sat the bench. I mean, you might have been on punishment. I mean, there's different aspects, and I don't necessarily believe that, well, because I've seen a freshman come in and beat, I've seen a teammate beat somebody, but that teammate can't beat the people he can beat. I mean, I've seen so many different scenarios where this challenge ladder might not be the best method. Why? Because, I mean, I've just seen it, and I'd love for you to come back and share some insight on that. I mean, I would love for that.
Yeah,
I'd
love to tell you about how we ran ladders and how we ran our challenges and how important that aspect is, and how I can get into why we did that and how it worked on many different levels.
Yes. I would definitely love for that. So, Shoes will get with you and bring you back. But, Coach, this has been great. Like I said, I'm on my fourth paper. And, no, I don't do team tennis, but I run my program sometimes as a team. I mean, when one person – I mean, I believe in peer pressure. If somebody doesn't want to move, everybody runs. Well, then by the time I've found out, by the time – them girls or whoever didn't run, by the time they run around, they run them laps, they're going to peer pressure, I find, is to be a big power. And the fact about, you know, how you teach your players how to feed, I think that's, I mean, I've seen it. I've seen it in a book. I've seen different drills. And I've also started implementing it into some of my programs where it doesn't allow me to be stationary. On two courts, I can have four feeders. I can see things. I can go around, correct different technical things I see. I can go around and motivate. Sometimes kids are not – sometimes kids are like human too. They need to be motivated. So I can see the motivation. I can get into them a little bit more. But I think one of the things that it does that people don't really understand, the feeder now gets a chance to see – when you tell that player, you've been telling a feeder to get his elbow up. Now when he feeds a player who doesn't get his elbow up, he gets a chance to see what you've been telling him to do all this time. I mean, I use it for a lot of different reasons. You know, you're like, oh, that's what you meant by getting my elbow up. Correct. Why? Because they're now feeding the ball. They're focused on the player that they're feeding it to. So now they kind of can analyze why they're messing up.
It's a great learning experience for the feeder. And obviously it's not as easy as I'm making it sound. It does take a while for the feeders to learn to feed the ball well.
Yeah.
It's not as easy as I'm making it out to be, but
I agree with
it is something we have done. But let me close by saying one additional thought, and that is I've used every aspect of my coaching career in my professional teaching career and working with top-ranked players and developing players in clubs and those kind of events. And like you said, Wes, people love to be part of a team. And when you make your club program, we and this is, again, something that's in my books and we'll talk about another time, but when you can develop your kids to feel like they're part of a team rather than they're just learning from you, the pro, and then they go home. Anytime that you can create these kind of avenues to create a team-like setting, even in a club, even at a facility with, a resort, you are going to not only keep those kids forever, they're going to tell other friends, you're going to get more and more kids that are going to want to be part of your team rather than just be taking lessons.
Yes, I agree. I'm team. It's a team. We travel. I mean, we're tournament this weekend. We're going as a team. I mean, we're a team.
That's great.
I mean, and that's just how it goes. I mean, I have a 10-year-old go hit with I have an 18-year-old. Why? Yes. Why? Because at that 18, I just believe we're a team. We're doing this as a team. We're focused as a team, and we play as a team. We support each other. We learn to be team players. And I tell people this all the time. I hear people talk about, well, tennis. If you want to play college tennis, you better learn how to be a team, because that's what team is about. It's not college single tennis. It's a team tennis concept, and you've got to start it somewhere. And I think team is – I get a lot of – I myself get a lot of success out of running my programs that we're all a team. I don't care if it's a beginner we're responsible for you. The best player responsible for the worst player. So therefore, that gives that best player a sense of a leadership, gives them a sense of responsibility. But it now – breaks the. I mean, I've seen players who are beginners break the ice with somebody who is the best player there. Why? Because the best player now took you over to try to help you. Different. It's just all about confidence, and it's all about growing together. You know, growing
Absolutely.
Together.
Yeah. Well, let me just mention all the stuff that we've talked about is in Coaching Mastery, my second of my two books, my two top four selling books, Tennis Mastery and Coaching Mastery. So people that want to read a lot more details about some of the things we've talked about, and obviously these are almost 400-page books, they can get Coaching Mastery and Tennis Mastery at any Barnes & Noble, Amazon, anywhere. Tennis Warehouse carries one of my big distributors and sellers of the books. But they're just I've tried to put everything my father taught me and everything I've learned from so many pros like Susan, yourself, from pros that Ken DeHart and Rick Macy and Robert Lansdorp and these guys that Jim McClellan and just guys that I've been fortunate enough to be part of the industry, if you will. We've all learned, and I do not claim that I've come up with all the information. I've learned it from standing on the shoulders of the giants and people who have unselfishly given of their experiences to myself and others. So I encourage people that want more information, they can always contact me on Facebook. I've got a special deal for any of your CTC player individuals that I try to give them a special deal, so they can always contact me as well.
And they're great books. I mean, I live and sleep with mine. Well, Susan, we've got about a minute and a half. So, Susan, I want you to give the final words and just take us on out of here. But, Coach, I want to thank you, and I know the listeners thank you for this great knowledge, and we're going to have you back. And I just want to say, excellent. I mean, great job, and I enjoy every time I hear you. I enjoy it every single time, and I appreciate it.
Well, I enjoy
you, Coach.
Enjoy you guys and Wes. I always said this several times, but I don't say it enough publicly, and that is, you provide a great vehicle on Facebook to give coaches, hundreds of us out there now. On I don't know what's the number of 600 now. I have no idea what your number
members?
Is.
Members,
yeah.
We're pushing 4,000. Actually, we're pushing.
Holy cow.
Yes, we're at 38.38 last time I looked at it, but I stopped. I stopped looking.
That's something to be proud of, and I'm very, very happy to always check in and say hi and share any insights
it,
I can.
I appreciate it, Coach.
Well,
Susan, take us out of here.
Hey, Coach, thanks for coming on, and what a wealth of information for people, for coaches that have high school programs, junior high programs, own academies. want to grow their academies, but not quite sure how to do a wide variety of things. I don't think there's any greater resource than Dave and those books. They're blueprints on how to run really highly successful programs. Great information for parents to know on what to look for really successful programs and thriving programs. So I can't thank Dave enough for sharing his knowledge and his Wednesday night with us. And please, let's have you back on in the next week or two and ask you a few more questions on the different things that Wes brought up. So thanks, Coach.
You bet. Thanks, Sue. Thank Wes. Thank you, Wes.
Thanks, Coach. Thanks, Coach.
Talk to you Wes. Soon.
Okay, thanks.
Talk to you soon.
Well, Susan, we've got a good show coming up, another good show coming up this Sunday. It's going to be a surprise. I think it's going to be a couple of you. I'm not even going to tell you. It's going to be your boys. Some of your colleagues, some of the guys that you've helped, named Jared Flick and Dawua. It's going to be a nice little round table. You're going to have a nice little round table conversation.
I'm looking forward to that. Can't wait to talk to my guys.
That's right. Well, Susan, I want to thank you, like always, for being such a great super host. And we've got about 2 seconds to get out of here. Coach is just so good. I just have so many notes and so many different things. My players are going to be like, oh, Lord, he's learned some more stuff. But, Susan, I want to thank you for tonight, and I look forward to talking to you and doing our show again Sunday. Susan, take us out of here.
All right, everybody. Hope you get so much information. And everybody, we will see you on Sunday. We'll see what Wes has lined up, and expect another killer show. I mean, we're on a roll. So, Wes, good night, and we'll talk to you soon.
Good night, Susan. Good night, everyone. Thanks again.
Thanks, bud.